I really am so honored to be here, but I'm also so honored to be a part of this, and so honored to be part of what many of you have said is part of your childhood, part of your past. Because I think through the years in pro wrestling, I started in 1983, I think through the years in pro wrestling, one thing has been static. One thing has remained the same, and that is respect and the love for this. Am I right? Everybody's got a story. Everybody's got a story when they first saw the Four Horsemen and when the Horsemen made an impact on their lives. Everybody's got one. I've got one. Mine is being hungover the next day, but everybody's got one about their stories with the Four Horsemen. And I'm so honored to be standing here to talk to these gentlemen because they have made an impact in my life, in your life, and from everybody watching here on Fight. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, in no particular order, let's bring in Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Barry Windham, J.J. Dillon, Lex Luger, and the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. Let's bring in the Horsemen. James J. Dillon. Tully Blanchard. Barry Windham. Arn Anderson. The Nature Boy, Ric Flair. And Lex Luger. Why did you put Flair beside of me?
Because you need him down there by you.
This is wonderful. This is great being able to connect with all these guys. And actually, this is the first time. I just saw him for the first time a few hours ago. Obviously, I still work with Arn and still work with Tully. But to be able to see Barry and be able to see this man right here, who was so instrumental in me still being here today. And obviously Lex, and it's just great. First of all, Rick, the Four Horsemen has kind of transcended wrestling. I mean, it really has. And it's because of the impact you guys had on 605 on Saturday nights. And you guys would go out and you would do those interviews. And we hear about scripted interviews and we hear about produced interviews. But you would just go out and you would pull the people in, and you would talk, and it was a magic to it, and it took talent that I don't think you see today. Right. 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 It was probably the end of 85, wasn't it? Don't you think, after Starcade, around that time?
End of 85?
Yeah, end of 85. Probably after Starcade, I think, going into 86. Is when you mentioned that, because I went back and watched that. Right. 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 And the, of course, the original Four Horsemen included Ole Anderson. Ole could not be here, obviously, but he still lives in Georgia. But he was the original, one of the original members of the Four Horsemen. Then you did that angle to where I think, Tully, you said you should be here instead of being watching your snot-nosed kid wrestle somewhere, and he slapped you. And then he was out of the Horsemen.
And I got beat up for 6 months.
Absolutely. And then Lex came aboard, as Ricky were saying, and Lex, you know, when you came in, first thing you said when you came in, I want to be a member of the Four Horsemen. And then Barry, who was wrestling at that time, came up to you, because I'm holding the microphone, said, no, you don't want to do that. You don't want to be a member of the Four Horsemen. And you obviously became a member of the Four Horsemen. And I remember, actually, when you, the Four Horsemen, I think it may have been the second clash. We did an angle outside of the Knight Center where you came in the limousine, and the Four Horsemen beat you up at that time.
In Miami Beach.
In Miami Beach, absolutely. At the Knight Center, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Got it. I remember that. Oh, I know. I know. Yeah. Yeah. He's talking about Bruce MacArthur, whose family has the Wurtz Corporation, who owned the Chicago Blackhawks. They still own the Blackhawks part of it? Okay, okay. There was a, and just a story, and actually this story is selfish plug in my comic book. There's a whole chapter dedicated to the time that we worked Hammond, Indiana, went to Chicago on Rush Street, and pulled back a few. And then when Rush Street closed down, the general says, I know a place in Cicero. So we ended up going to Cicero, right? Okay, you think so. Okay. So it was I know Arn and Tully and me and Bruce MacArthur and JJ. Barry may have been with us, I'm not sure. So I have to go and do a radio show in the morning, just do my sports report. So I go to a payphone in this dive in Cicero, okay, and do the sports report, which is like a 2 minutes long on a payphone, and I come back to our table. Everybody's gone. It was a rib. They piled in the limousine and left my ass in Cicero at like 4 o'clock in the morning. So I walk outside, look around, and I'm thinking, what the hell? What's going on? And finally, the limousine pulls back, and Bruce MacArthur says, see, always stay with the boys. And he, on your 70th birthday party, he looked at me and went, Cicero!
Yeah.
I went, damn, shouldn't go with the Four Horsemen. But
by the way, how did I live to be 70? Much less 73. That's a miracle.
Yeah. Well, Barry, it's great seeing you. We don't get to see each other that much anymore. And obviously, you were one of the great performers ever in this business. And you've been, right? It's Barry Windham, not tremendous. And, of course, you know, you had a great run with and against the Horsemen as well.
Yeah. Me and Dustin or Steamboat and I, mean, we right. just had all different combinations.
Right.
Sting, Cougar.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of combinations.
Right. Now, when did you start with JCP? Do you remember the year? Was it like, because
late 86, early 87.
Right, because you and Rotunda was with the WWE, with WWF at that time.
Magnum Matt is right.
Right. Yeah. But you had wrestled with JCP as Blackjack Mulligan Jr. early, right?
Yeah, in
1980.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So you went there, went to the WWE, came back, and of course, I mean, the mid-80s were just a wonderful time for all of us, right?
Yeah, they were. They were exciting. We were in different towns every night. It was a great time.
Right, right. Of course. Yeah.
Hey, I got a great Barry Windham story. So
okay.
We're going to Louisville on a jet. I said, Barry, what time are you getting up? What time are you coming? He said, I'm driving down. Barry had a Porsche that go about 3,000 miles an hour. Literally, he kept it like at about 130. And I'll be damned if he wouldn't at the hotel in Louisville. Before we got there, we flew down in a jet.
I dropped you off at the airport.
Yeah, I think you did.
God. I barely remember it.
Well, I've got a great Barry Windham story that I'm going to hold on to in just a second. But, J.J., you were kind of you were always, regardless of the different formations of the horsemen, you were always a part of it. You were always there with them. And I get the feeling sometimes that there was never really a plan for what you guys were going to say, but it always seemed to work out. I mean, if you recall, regardless, it would seem, it didn't happen all the time, but it seemed like most of the time, when we would finish on TBS and finish that two-hour show, it would end with the horsemen around the podium. Is that right, JJ? And you guys, sometimes you guys would come out and talk. Tell me if I'm wrong, okay? You would come out and cut a great promo, okay? Dusty would come out and cut a promo. You come out and cut a great promo. Dusty would come back out and try to top it. And then we have the horseman at the very end. And I'm thinking, this is freaking great. This is the greatest thing in the world. And when you look back on it, it is better today than when we did it at the time. I mean, I don't know what that says about what's going on today in wrestling, but when you look at that stuff from 80, 85, 86, 87, it's better today than it was, JJ. You can answer with it. You can put that microphone to your mouth and say something.
Yeah,
instead of shaking your head, you go ahead.
No, I'm soaking all this in. You know, this is a very rare occasion for all of us. You would think, as much success that we had, that we would be somewhere every weekend being around each other. But, you know, we each had our own lives and went our separate ways. And yet, anytime we were together, the level of success we had was phenomenal. And after all these years, how many times in the wrestling business can something be remembered as a good time 30 years after the fact? It just, it's timeless. And what made it so special for me is a lot of things in wrestling where somebody in creative had an idea about let's do this or let's do that. And with us, I think the secret of success was it was all spontaneous. We all, you know, we're at the top of our own game and we genuinely enjoyed each other's company. And if we had a day off, you would think that, you know, like even the brothers that are very tight have a day off, and the last thing they want to see is their other brother. With us, we would have a day off, and where would we be? One of us, you would go to somebody's house, and there we would all be. That we genuinely enjoyed each other's company because it was a magical time in the business that I'll go so far as to say few people experience what we experienced. We all had our individual lives, we lived different places, but there was a genuine friendship among us and a camaraderie that you can't create something like that, you can't fake something like that. It's genuine. And the fact that all these years later, that I'm sure you people didn't come just to see us, but the fact that we could be up here and that you choose to be here and listen to whatever we're going to talk about, and we don't need a specific topic or something to go off on. We're here and we just thoroughly enjoy each other's company. And I know for me, I'm thankful when I see all these faces out here that I like to think that we did something right. And
hey,
that's the reason that you're here, because we're coming back to celebrate it, and you should give yourselves a hand because you were such a big part of it. That as much as fun as we were having and the success that we had, we owe it to each and every one of you. That everybody, you know, works hard and has a choice of where they spend their money. And you supported us, and all success that we have is you. So I'd like everybody here, give yourselves a round of applause, because that's how we feel about it.
Hey, can I tell, we not only were we cohorts on the road and you know, lived our life of wrestling, but we were so close as individuals off the road. Like, we just had habits. We did the same things. Like, we'd get off the plane, and we'd, like, go to a place called Bennington sometimes. So I was with JJ one night, and I had an argument with my wife, my second wife. Oh, you got to clarify that. And I punted her purse across the bar. And I said, JJ, take me to my house. I got to make sure she doesn't come home and steal Ashley, Charlotte. Because she said, I'm taking Charlotte leaving. So JJ drove me to my house. I went inside. I crawled into the crib. And I was going to make sure the best didn't
sound
take
Charlotte. Fell sound asleep.
Huh? Let me finish the story.
Okay, go ahead.
So I wake up in the morning, and I look in the crib, and Ashley is gone, Charlotte. And I walk out the driveway, and JJ is in the car like this, oh, yeah, with the motor still running, 7 hours later. Sound asleep. So I said, where the hell's my daughter? He said, I don't know. So I went over to his house with him, and boy, there were two wives that were really pissed, boy. I looked at JJ had his head on the counter like this. I said, JJ, what's wrong? He said, don't ask.
You walked in the front door, and you saw the tirade from the wife, and you told me that you expected me to be standing there like a soldier at attention, and because you couldn't see me. You could just see the browbeating that I was taking. And but what is it that you remember?
You had your hands in your head. You weren't allowed out of your room. And that was a regular affair.
You know what? And really, we're talking about how amazing the Horsemen would perform on Saturdays on TBS. You would see it at 6:05, but we would shoot it earlier that morning. And everybody would get there around, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And it was amazing that they could perform and they could talk after the night that they had. Because you guys worked, I mean, like JJ said, you worked all the time. And you tried to find time to work out. And obviously you would stay up late at night having something to eat. Right, right. Worked in St. Louis, would fly in or whatever. Tully, just to give you a Tully Blanchard story, Tully may not remember this, and I won't go into detail, but Tully is the only man in the history of my existence to get me locked out of my own house. We pulled up in that blue Cadillac at the townhome Lois and I was renting, and I went, and she had locked the door on me. And finally, when she opened the door, I mean, I was singing like a baby. It's that damn Tully Blanchard. Some bitch kept me out late. It's not my fault. Remember the blue Cadillac?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you do.
I was the brunt of a lot of stories.
Yeah. But Tully, when did you start with JCP? When did you start with the Crockett's?
Actually, I started with Crockett in 1977.
77?
Yes. And when I just started, I just graduated from college and went to Florida and worked for the Grahams, and then came up in May, and I was there for May to December. And then I went back to Texas to work for my dad.
Right.
And stayed there for 6 years. And then came back in 1984, and that's when everything started.
Right.
And so that was a very exciting time in my life.
Right.
And then stayed in the Carolinas for the next 20-some years.
Right.
And then before I moved back to Texas in 2012. So,
having your father as a promoter in the business, you obviously did everything in the business. I mean, you.
Oh, I've swept arenas, put up rings,
right?
Put up chairs, put up flyers,
right?
Sold tickets,
right?
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And of course, you and JJ were together, Tully Blanchard Enterprises. Everybody remember that during the Horseman era, right?
Before the Horseman era. It was Tully Blanchard Enterprises before the Horseman.
Right.
And so it was great to be go on TV every week with James J. And the most articulate man I know. And when I started, back when I was refereeing, JJ was the greatest bump taker in professional wrestling, too, just to go a little bit of history. Because they were perfect every night. Him and Harley Race are the two greatest meticulous perfection on a bump ever you ever take. But that's just my opinion.
No, and Murdoch was good too. Hello. Yeah, Murdoch was good too. But what had happened was that before wrestling, because I'm originally from New Jersey, and when I was in high school, there was no high school wrestling anywhere in the state of New Jersey. So I went to a college in Reading, Pennsylvania, Albright College, and had been told by one of the old-timers, George Bolas, the original Zebra Kid, I told him I wanted to be in wrestling, and he said, well, learn the fundamentals of amateur wrestling first, and you may question, you know, that these seem like two directly opposite things. Why would you say that? And he, you know, convinced me early on that it would be to my advantage, that I would have a more successful career if I learned the fundamentals of amateur wrestling. So, like I said, they didn't have any in New Jersey. I never saw an amateur match until I went to college. I went to a small school, Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania, and went out for the wrestling team and never even seen an amateur match. And in eastern Pennsylvania, there's like umpteen schools, and there's so many high school wrestling programs that the level of competition in those and all, every one of those schools was unbelievable. And here I am, you know, thrown into that mix like a fish out of water. And so I had to learn, you know, learn pretty quick. But those were wonderful years. I have such fond memories. And what's so amazing is that the Horsemen were, you know, we lived in different varied parts of the country. We all had our own interests. And yet when we were together, you know, we were friends for life. And still have that same friendship. And it doesn't have to be somebody that you call every Sunday or go over their house. It's just, and it's like I went through a divorce and came home one day and all my worldly belongings were out on the front porch. and I told Tully, you know, as well, you know, I've done it again. I mean, I've really done it this time. And Tully had a beautiful house, and without a moment's hesitation, I don't know if you remember this, but you said, put everything you can in your trunk, and if we have to make an extra load, we will. You come over here, and you live with me. And you did. And that's what I did. I went over and lived with, and so I said to Tully, I said, well, I should help with the rent. We have no part of that. And I said, well, let me help with the expenses. No part of that. And yes, we were all successful, but it, you know, just seemed like the right thing to do. So when I finally moved out, I found Tully always was a great dresser and always had really nice clothes. And I found out who his tailor was and went to the tailor and I said, you do Tully's clothes? Yeah. He's got great taste in clothes. And he said, in fact, he just ordered a new suit that he had been fitted for. And I said, you know, I'm thinking a new suit. How much can a new suit cost? I said, I want to pay for the suit. How much is it? And then he said, $700. And when I came
That's because I went to Flair's Taylor.
So anyway, I stayed with Tully, and he will always be a friend for life, because we all have times, good times, bad times, and at a time of need, when a guy said, you know, you come and you just move in with me, and I said, well, I want to give you, you know, help with the rent. No, there was no discussion. He wouldn't even let me discuss it. And like I said, I finally found out that he had ordered a new suit, went to get to the tailor, and Tully hadn't picked it up yet. I said, how much is the suit? And he said, Tully dresses really well, really nice. The suit was $700 and some, and I bought your suit.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah. Lex, when you came aboard from Florida Championship Wrestling, did you realize how your life was going to change as far as professionally? Because that kickstarted a tremendous career in wrestling. And talk about when you first came in to Jim Crockett Promotions and getting to know this man right here, Ric Flair, and the members of the Horsemen. Talk about that for us.
Yeah, very briefly, first of all, this event, the staffing and what Conrad's come up with the concept, and for the turnout of you, the fans, and the following after over 30 years, the loyalty and the love you guys show towards us just continues to blow my mind. I want to thank everybody for that right up front, and this group of guys here. And Tony, for this group of guys up here, first of all, Nate plucked me out of Florida. I was a rookie in wrestling, and Nate plucked me out, and they picked me. And when I think of the opportunity to work with this group of guys at the level of maturity in the wrestling business, me as a rookie, and to be able to be brought in with them under their mentorship and approval, this is elite, high-level stuff up here on this stage. And to be able to be taught and brought along by them. Rick actually came down to Florida initially to kind of discover me and wrestled me in a one-hour Broadway. I don't know how. Talk about a testament to Rick's abilities to have a wrestling match with almost anybody. Rick, you remember you called the Sunset Flip, but I didn't know what it was?
I got to chime in on this. So that's when I was still traveling as the world champion. And so Bob Roop and Hiro Matsuda were booking the territory. So they said to me, this kid's only been wrestling about 3 months. Can you go an hour with him? I said, go an hour with him? 3 months? I hadn't met Lex. And here comes this guy walking in a room, 6'5". And I know this goes unnoticed now because it's like accepted, but here's this guy, I would say, between he and Kerry Von Erich, maybe a couple other guys who I'd have to think back, the best physique in the history of the business.
Right.
But really, you and Kerry Von Erich, I'm looking at guys, and obviously a great athlete, played collegiate and pro football. So, buddy wasn't ready to go an hour, okay? So I took two blades, one under my tongue and one in my mouth. We got an hour. I took 27 press slams and walked around the ring, but we made it.
I was so nervous. I go, how am I going to wrestle for an hour?
Well,
I can't wrestle 5 minutes.
Put a guy in an hour Broadway, it's a lot of time to kill. Bret Hart said to me today, you were really repetitious. I said, yeah, how many hour Broadway did you wrestle with a guy been in the business 3 months?
But I always, I've told Rick this before, but the love I have for Nate, I'm so excited about him for this weekend. There would not be a Lex Luger if it wasn't for Ric Flair. I think one of Rick's most, of all the incredible traits and talents that he has, not only is he one of the biggest stars ever in wrestling, bar none, but he was also a star maker. And that's a very unique quality.
Absolutely.
And to be able to work with these guys, Tony, night in, night out, I had to learn not. Rick taught me not to. We didn't get a lot of sleep, did we, Nate?
No. He's the only guy. We shared a room one time, and while we're watching TV, getting ready to go to the match, and they're doing crunches. He said, Nate, this is what you got to do all the time. He said, when you're driving on the highway, what do you call that when you isometric. Suck your stomach in. I go, when I drive down the highway.
I still do those.
But, I mean, the guy, he taught you revolutionized. I think Arn and everybody will agree that, number one, we all got in the tanning bed a lot more after Lex got here. He created the tanning bed market. And I think that we enjoyed it, you know. I'm going to be quite honest with you. Lex didn't drink, and I'll probably take credit for that. But once they got him on a vodka cranberry, man, they're hard to put down after you've been out for 3 hours wrestling and sweating with the road warriors.
Dusty told you guys to leave me alone outside of the ring, remember?
Not a chance.
I have an orange story that I got to tell. We were in Chicago, and there was a place called Snuggery's.
Snuggery's, yep.
A place called the Snuggery.
And it which, if you go out for nightlife in Chicago, this city never sleeps. So the next day, Arn was supposed to meet his wife, and they had planned to go to Hawaii, right, for vacation. And it was like Arn told everybody, you know, I got to kind of take it easy tonight because my wife, she's flying in to meet me, and we're going to, this is a vacation that she has waited so long and planned so much for that, you know, I don't want anything to spoil it. Well, we stayed at the one hotel was owned by
Bruce
MacArthur.
The Bismarck.
I mean,
he tore it down, thank God.
Oh. So it ended up that, I guess, maybe a little bit by design, a little bit by accident, kept Arn out awful. And we were in a room that had like two bunk beds, and Arn kept saying, I got to meet Arn, and we're going to Hawaii, and she's been planning this trip, and I got to get some sleep. And so what I do remember is that Arn set his alarm for like 7 a.m. to get up to go meet his wife. And when we finally let him go to bed, I think the way you tell the story, you put your head on the pillow, and almost simultaneously the alarm went off.
No shit. I begged these guys. I said, I am meeting Aaron in Dallas. She's coming from Charlotte. We are going on my first vacation that Jim Crockett actually paid for to Hawaii. I said, listen, tonight, let's just take it easy, okay? Rick goes, well, listen, I've taken care of this. The limo driver is just going to stay with you tonight. He's in your hip pocket. He will take you to the airport in the morning. So I said, okay, well, what? He's going to just do what? He's going to sit in the lobby? Yeah, he'll just hang out in the lobby. It won't be that long. I said, bullshit, he's coming and sleeping with me. He's not getting out of my eyesight. And literally, by the time we got back to the room, and this is trying to take it easy, I literally, yes, got naked. That's got naked for sleeping, folks. Laid my head on the pillow, and the alarm went off. And the wake-up call from the operator, and anybody that's experienced that, know that's a horrifying feeling, hear all that shit going off. So I go and I shake who is sleeping on the couch. I shake Bill, the limo driver. Wasn't his name Bill? Get up. And he sat up. He had chili three ways on the front of his shirt and shit. So he takes me to the airport, and let's just say it was miserable. When I got to Dallas and I'm walking down to the gate where I'm meeting Aaron, and I can see her from about 30 feet. She stopped walking and just gave me the death stare, and I went, oh, I must look like hammered dog shit. Yes, it was verified. We haven't had a vacation since I've known you, and we finally get one, and you just screw it all up like this. Jesus Christ. So that was just one episode. Another time in Chicago, we got tore up, and David Crockett and Tony Giovanni thought it would be a humanitarian effort to take me to the hotel. This time I had earned that. This was one of those kamikaze nights, probably 20 beers and about 8 kamikazes. So I must have been really tore up.
And yeah, you were. David Crockett went to the front desk. Why? I held you up behind a plant so nobody would see you. I did. So you wouldn't fall down. And I said, David, go to the front, check him in, because he's going to fall on the floor. So I was hanging on to you. It was like Weekend at Bernie's. Okay?
Yes. Yes. Okay, so we've agreed.
So
I was tore up.
So we open the door to the room.
Hold
and
it.
Just throw your ass in the room in the bed, close the door and leave.
Yeah, yeah. So they go, that's okay, Arn. We'll get make sure you get back. And they throw me in the room, shut the door. Okay, I wake up the next morning, and I look around. I go, damn, we got to go pretty quick. And I start calling Tony Giovanni's room. No Tony Giovanni's registered here, sir. David Crockett's room. How about Tully Blanchard? How about J.J.? I think they're ribbing me. And they said, no, sir, none of those people are here. Well, they checked me into a hotel, but it wasn't our hotel. So now put yourself in this position. You wake up. You are hammered. You sit up. You get on the phone, start calling people. There were no cell phones or any of that. Okay, so you run out of names talking to the operator, and none of those people are there. Then what? Brilliant idea. I'll call the Wirtz Corporation.
Oh, wow. That worked.
Bruce MacArthur, who this is, you know, like calling Donald Trump. Lady answers the phone. Dr. Wirtz's office. Yeah, this is Arn Anderson. I'm one of his friends. It's a wrestler. I'm lost. I don't know where the hell he is. I need to talk to Bruce. Sorry, sir. He's in a corporate meeting. I don't give a shit. He's maybe in a meeting. I am in some hotel. I don't know where anybody is, including myself. So, thank you, Tony. Finally, Bruce said, where you at, Arn? And I said, da-da-da-da-da, hotel. He said, well, hell, they're not staying there. They're over at the other place. So, thank you, Tony.
First hotel we could find, we threw you in it. It's what friends are for, brother.
You guys suck.
Arn, I wanted to ask you something about the formation of the Four Horsemen. And you're the one that coined the phrase. When that happened, I know we're talking 36 years ago. I get it. But when you coined that phrase, the Four Horsemen, what were you? Did I just come to you on the spur of the moment, just like that?
I have no idea. God's truth, you know. It was like I know that in those days I would read the USA paper or the Bible or whatever it was and get quotes that I could apply to who and what I was talking. And the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, to me, I mean, it's pretty damn frightening if you start reading that stuff. And we're in a promo situation where we had like 3 minutes, 30 seconds, and for the first time, they put us out there with Rick. Rick always had an individual promo, and the rest of us would kind of share the rest of that time, but I'm kind of looking at the monitor, and I'm looking at Tully and JJ, and I'm looking at Rick, and there's me and Ole, and I went, damn, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and it literally, I swear to God, just popped in my head. I wish I could tell you I was brilliant and sat in a dim light at night and sketched it out, thought about it all night. No, it just popped in there.
Right.
And you, if you hadn't have done what you did, and it was like it just flowed and it worked and okay. And when it was over, you walked over to me and went, Jesus Christ, Arn, you just named you guys. And it was that profound. I went, well, really? And we kind of talked about it a little bit, and, you know, we got to the house shows, and, you know, Four Horsemen, and where's the thumb? It's missing. But this thing, we started this, and I'm not kidding you guys. Y'all did it, if there's any grandfathers in here. Y'all set it on fire because it started. It literally started, and with 2 weeks, everybody in the heel side of the audience were doing this. And we were not liked, but there were scattered spatterings of fans that picked up with this thing. And, man, we went with it, and it became something special. And I'll tell you why it worked. People have asked me, why did it work? And I'm sure that there's grandfathers and fathers and in case something. That's not wrestling. Wrestling was the horsemen. They were the shit. And you know what? You were right. But it was because of an ongoing effort by every one of us to make everybody in that other life. If we could get all those guys over, business was going to take off. And that's a very unselfish thought process that does not exist anymore and probably never will again. Barry would come out behind us and do everything in his power to outshine us. If it was Tully and I after Barry, we would go out, try to outshine him, and we would make Rick have to go damn near 60 men when you could believe in. That was when there were good guys and there were bad guys, and it was easy to tell that story, guys. It really was. You just had to have the frame of mind of, for all you audience members, you probably didn't want all over the arena and having to run from those good guys and let that last scene be what you saw that night. And it was very unselfish out of all these guys, and that's why it's last so long. I don't know.
The good guys, the incident, are called the baby faces, and the bad guys are called the heels. And as a general rule of thumb, that one of them loses a match or gets pinned, then that aura disappears. What made there was something, and it's hard to verbalize it to somebody else. And when somebody says, "Well, can you describe it?" No, I'm sorry, I can't. But I can tell you when I see somebody if they've got it. Lost matches every night, but of course a lot of it is what you did during the course of your match. But you're in there, you figure you're in with the Road Warriors, and it was like if we could get us back on TV and give us a mic and then stand back. And that's where Arn was, he was a genius. A lot of it is how you do it, and then if you can get back on TV and tell your side of the story, the fans are the same fans that saw you get than hell because they know that you're bullshit.
Hey, I'm going to jump in here. Obviously, I'll all agree. Arn and I talked about it a lot afterwards. I mean, who hasn't? If the Crockett's had stayed east of the Mississippi instead of trying to go to California, and we took over Baltimore. We didn't take over Philadelphia because they were selling out. We're in a smaller building. But it was 10,000. It was for a while, too, based around the guys I started out in the business with. But Arn and I and Tully and Barry or Lex, whatever the combination was, never sat down. Well, he used to say, cut him off. I'd say, cut him off for what? They ain't sitting down. And all of a sudden, Arn would pop in and smile down, right?
You bet.
Arn would pop in, yeah, and then all of a sudden, of course, Joe would throw Arn over the top rope, pressing out of it, but we cut him off more. We sold, we couldn't wait to get there. It's like, we got in a suntan bed, we wrestled, we drank, we went, making double shots and that, but, the thing I think is unique, and those guys said it, is we didn't think about putting guys over, we lose every night. It didn't matter. It's just the psychology of the business now is different, but right now, to this day, is when Arn left WWE, because if you've been a tag team guy like Arn, yeah, no. I don't know, but he should be an agent. Are you an agent for? I didn't know. Sometimes people, you have to sit and talk to them for a long time, and it takes a lot of patience. But we had a lot of fun, and we entertained a lot of people. And everything I did for 3 hours over the day, I'm sure they did too, was this. So, I mean, it's going to go on forever. If we'd had a market, if Vince had back then, God only knows how many t-shirts would have sold. We would have made a lot of money.
So. No question. We, in the Crockett's Garage, doing the local promos, that was magical stuff. And a lot of that stuff is no longer available. The local promos that we used to do. And it was, and we had a great time. Right? Yeah, it was great.
I remember in Chicago, it was a watering hole called, I think they called the Snuggery. And, you know, they change owners and the names of the place change. But on Chicago TV, just mention the name of the stall. We're going to have a few laughs at the Snuggery tonight. And we would get to the Snuggery and waiting for us to arrive. And I know I would go in first and I would put a credit card down on the bar. And the bartender would look at it and throw it back at me and say, it's no good here tonight. And he knew that we were going to be there because we told him, and our money wasn't any good. It was just a magical time in the business that I don't know that it'll ever be duplicated.
Okay, we got Malcolm. Where are you, buddy?
Right here.
Now, yeah, okay. We got some questions. When you stand up and ask a question, please put the microphone up to your mouth, okay? Speak loud. Tell us your name.
All right, raise your hand.
Okay.
What's your name?
My name is Michael. Speak up for us.
Sure. My name is Michael McClanahan, and my question is evolution. I was wondering if we could get some of your thoughts on how the Four Horsemen kind of served as a launching pad for modern wrestling. And as always, thank you, gentlemen, so much for your time. This has been a wonderful event.
Okay. Thank you. Question was, if I got this right, how the Horsemen have launched modern-day wrestling. The Horsemen and what you did launch modern-day wrestling. I get that right, Michael? Modern-day factions. Okay? Because we see a lot of... Do you think you were the forefront of groups and factions today?
Say that one more time, guys. I apologize. I am deaf in this ear. No shit.
Okay. All right. The question was, Arn, how many kamikazes did you have that night?
It was at night. It was not last night.
Now, we're talking about today you hear of factions, different groups. How do you think of Four Horsemen... started all of that?
I'm not sure we started it, because now it's a loosely group of guys who are loosely put together and can be done in one night, other than the way the Horsemen evolved. I don't know if that group of guys with that mindset in today's product would work, because in all fairness, JJ said, you know, we never lost a match. Well, I don't think we ever lost or never won a match. We never lost a match on TV. Every week we got to go pound the shit out of some poor soul because the Road Warriors killed us all weekend. And we always had promo time. And it was every single week, and you knew when you cut on the TV at 6:05, we were going to have a match, every one of us, and we were going to pound somebody, and then we were going to jump on the mic, and we were going to hammer Dusty, the Rock and Roll, Magnum, whoever we were talking about. In today's world, you do not get that amount of TV time. Nobody does. And you never have the opportunity to develop momentum. And as you know, the reason you rush home to cut on that TV set to watch a wrestling show is because somebody has momentum. And these guys, you know, it's not their fault. You may be on TV one week and not the next or the next, and then come back on the next one. So the Horsemen faction, unless we had the tools, Tony.
Yeah.
I think it was just a thing of the times, and not sure that would work in today's market.
Yeah. Listen, wait, the Horseman era in the mid-80s, you didn't watch the show to see a wrestling match. You know you didn't. You watched to see these guys talk. And that's what drew you in. And that's what brought people to the arena. Okay, next one. Tell us your name. Speak very loudly into the microphone.
Hi, my name's Chad. I'm from Vancouver, British Columbia. I came here just to see you guys and to see Rick's last match. My question is, there's a lot of great horsemen over the years. In the late 90s, I feel one of the most disappointing things was when Kurt Hennig joined the NWO instead of the Four Horsemen. I just wonder from Rick and Arn, you guys were there at the time, how do you think Kurt would have been as a horseman?
You don't want my answer, and that was one of the most hurtful moments of my life. And that's the guy's honest truth. When Arn was retiring, because I lived it with him, and what he went through with his neck for years before he actually had to walk away from it, that was me. And I know for a fact that when Sting ran up to me and said, "God damn, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen," Arn cut a world-class promo, and to this day, I'm pissed off about it. I'm sorry. That's got to be the truth. That was bullshit. Hey, he said something he meant. That's what nobody gets today. He didn't just read that off a script they gave. He said what he meant and what he felt in life. That's the difference in the business now. Think about it. You can't be that person. You can't be who you are if you don't feel it. How many guys have a gimmick? How many change their gimmick 10 times that have been in the business? There ain't one guy in this right here, we never change nothing. He's been the enforcer. Tully's been a technician. Barry's been one of the top 10 wrestlers of all time. Lex had a hell of a deal. I mean, none of us changed.
Yep.
And that was a bad moment for me. I'll never forget it, and I won't forgive it.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Matt, and I have a question for anyone on the panel. Memories of Ole Anderson.
Memories of Ole Anderson. Who wants to take this? Okay. Yeah, okay. I can give you an Ole story. When I came back to WCW in 1990, Ole was the booker. And we were all around the table at Jim Herd's room there, which was the most miserable time of my fucking life. Okay? Okay. All right. And it was me and Jim Herd and Jim Barnett and Ole and Jim Crockett. And we were sitting around the table and they were just ragging on Ole's booking. Just ragging on this didn't work and this didn't work. And Ole was sitting back with that, you know, that Banlon shirt of his in the chair. And there was a pause in the conversation, or I should say the bitching. Right? And Ole slapped the table as hard as he could with both hands. Boom! Everybody woke up. And he looked at Jimmy Crockett and he said, "God damn it, Jimmy, tell me one thing. No, tell me two things that you've ever booked in your life that fucking worked. Come on, tell me. Go ahead. I'm waiting. Go ahead, tell me." And he stood up and he walked down the hallway there. And Jim Barnett said, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. And Jim Crockett said, "I'm going home to Dallas. Fuck this. I don't need this shit." So I get up and I walk down the hallway where the bathroom was on the 12th floor there, and Ole's standing there with his hands on his hips. He looks at me and said, "How'd you like that for a promo, kid?" And I said, "You were working in there?" He said, "Yeah, I didn't mean what I was saying. I just wanted to kind of jazz it up a little bit." And that's the kind of guy he was. He was like, I mean, everything he said was legit, right? Every time he did an interview, you believed it. I mean, he used to come on Mid-Atlantic TV and used to tell, if you're a truck driver and you think you're a badass, well, you come on down to the Dorton Arena and we'll see how bad you are. And it was legit stuff. Right, Arn?
Credibility.
You want the best Ole Anderson story
of all time? Yes, I do.
Yes. Only because Barry's here. So Barry just breaking in the business. And it's Ole and Gene, right? And they were bullies.
Yeah.
They were just plain bullies. They would take guys and run them ragged up and down Coliseum steps and then kick the shit out of them. They were bullies. And they wrestled Blackjack and Barry. And they tried to fuck around with Barry. And Blackjack just fucking walked over and slapped fucking Gene Anderson so fucking hard. He sent the fucking matches over. They both walked down in the Norfolk. The dressing rooms are about 30 feet apart. He walked in there. He slapped Ole Anderson so fucking hard. I can still hear it. He said, "Don't ever touch my fucking kid again."
Oh, tremendous. Oh, yeah.
Jack Mulligan.
He did it
Jack
twice.
Mulligan, right in front of me, said, "I'm tired of this big asshole," and sucker punch Andre the Giant. Fuck. And Andre dragged him and Dick Murdoch out of the ocean and damn near drowned him. Wow, who said help? I said, "Fuck no. Not going out there." Jack would go, "I'm tired of this motherfucker talking so tough." Boom. Yeah. Hey, I got a better one yet. To Barry and I, Jack and I bought a motorhome, and our wives were going down to Myrtle Beach, and Barry was a senior in high school. And Barry, Jack and I work in Virginia. I had that limousine, right? We came back, and the guy in the motorhome was gone. Jack goes, "This, I'm sorry." I said, "Don't, I know, just make sure the girls get in the van tomorrow." He said, "I'm going to kill that kid." So I went, I couldn't help. I don't want to see him. I wanted to see what he pulled up. He pulled up, brother. I know. I was right in front of my house. I know. I heard it and I saw it. Tough love, man. Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Jack Mulligan was the dude, guys.
Yeah, man.
He's right there in the top five. He's right there with Haku and Harley.
All right, thanks for the question about Ole, by the way. Appreciate that. And, of course, listen, Jack Mulligan, when I was a fan, the greatest angle I've ever seen today was Blackjack and Ric Flair splitting up, the hat and the robe. Greatest angle ever. Greatest, I'm telling you, because I spent a lot of money for that angle, okay? They started out with six-man tags, and Flair would tag in, Blackjack would tag in, and Flair would go through the ropes. And they built it up, sold out everywhere.
The first time we sold out every arena in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
And for the Crockett, every arena.
Yeah. Greatest angle ever.
He tied those, brother. He came on TV with women's nylons and said, "Yeah, I'm going to put these on you when I see you in Roanoke."
Exactly. Okay. That was a commercial break.
Yeah,
okay.
I work for them. Be nice to them.
All right. Next question.
Next question comes from Peter.
Hi, guys. My name's Peter. My question is for Lex Luger. Lex Luger, I thought that your selling is, if you go back and look at all your matches, I thought your selling was top-notch. The realism you brought in the ring, the realism that you brought in your interviews was second to none. Did you ever get approached by any casting directors or film producers back in your heyday to be in films? And then my second question is to Mr. Ric Flair. Ric Flair, where's the party tonight?
What?
Rick, okay, 810, Ric Flair, where's the party tonight?
Tomorrow night. I'm actually going to go to bed tonight. Well, maybe.
Yeah.
Not right away.
Yeah. Yeah, bullshit.
Right away.
Lex, did you hear the question part to you?
I did. Is he serious?
If you want to be a movie star, say yes.
I was never good at selling. I always oversold when I did sell or undersell, and
hey,
Hollywood never came calling, so I don't. But thank you. If you're serious.
Here's my greatest Lex
Luger
story.
I thought maybe you just pulled my leg.
Okay.
Me and Arn and Lex pull up to go into the hotel bar or something like that, and Lex says, "Just a minute." He takes off his shirt, goes back, and grabs baby oil. Gasses up the arms. I go, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm making sure that they're highlighted." They just tell me.
Oh, I call it getting a sheen.
What a great time of life. Those plane rides.
I'll tell you how big a star Lex was. Lex, you probably don't remember this, but we were in a bar one time, and you had the bartender peel the shrimp for you. And I said, what? He said, yeah, I don't want to. The bartender peeled the shrimp for him. He had shrimp. He had the bartender peel the shrimp for him. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah, I don't want my hands to stink. So there you go, buddy. Here's a big star, man. Bartender just peeling that shrimp like a mark. Yeah. I'm peeling for Lex Luger. Yeah.
I was a muscled-up prima donna.
It stuck with me the rest of my life, I can tell you that. How much longer that's going to be, I don't know. Next question.
Now we have Scotty.
Thank you. So my question is, all the miles and the memories, first of all, thank each and every one of you for what you've done for all of us. Also, in the 1980s, were you just trying to stay booked? Were you just having fun? Did you know you were making magic? Did you take a moment, take a deep breath, and soak it in at any of the venues? Thank you.
Anybody want to talk about that? JJ, we only got 10 minutes left.
It's one of these things that we talk about it years later and look back with such fond memories. But at the time it was happening, we had no idea the magic that was taking place, and it was only virtually years later that we look back and realize what an incredible time in the business that it was, that all the diverse characters, and that, you know, that we were so blessed to be a part of it. It was just that simple. And again, it comes back to that it was you people sitting out here that really created the magic, that you saw something in us that you had never seen before, and it wasn't something that you could see that somebody was giving you a script or telling you what to say. The spontaneity of it all was also another part of what made it so magical.
All right, very cool. Next.
Now we have Mitchell.
Mitchell?
Yeah. It's a question to all of you. Whenever it was time to replace a member and come up with a new fourth member, who made that ultimate decision? Was that a joint decision amongst all the horsemen, or did it come down from above, or how was that handled?
What? Tully, you want to take that? When it was time to replace the four horsemen, who made that decision? Did you guys come up with it, or did
Dusty?
Dusty came up with it.
Well, it just
you had some input though, didn't you? Or did you?
I think we had input, but I think whoever was booking at that time, and you know, I think was agreed upon. But it just the thing between Lex and Barry couldn't have happened at a better time for both of them. It's one of those things that just happens once in a while, very rarely in the business, where you know you can inter swap both guys, and neither one of them gets demoted in the ladder in terms of their. I mean, Barry Windham will be one of the top 10 workers in the history of the business forever.
All right.
So, and Barry, unlike me, Barry can work both ways. No, that's a good deal. I think Arn will agree with me. I can't work babyface. Arn doesn't like working babyface either. I mean, there's some guys can do both. Steamboat can't be a heel. Steamboat's the greatest babyface of all time. Barry, to be able to do both, the same level of skill. Think about it. There are only a few guys in the business that can go both ways and be equally as good. Shawn Michaels being one. Now think about it. It's the kind of class Barry was in. Because he was big, he was smooth, he was easy, he was, you know, could go an hour, could go 10 minutes. And to be able to switch, you know, and I think Lex actually enjoyed being a heel more than a babyface. Would you say that? Yeah, once you've been a badass heel, especially when you're limited, I mean, all I do is chop somebody and go, woo. That's it. You know, that's kind of boring as a babyface. So,
don't you think all of you enjoyed being heels more than babyfaces? Yeah.
What?
Right? Don't you think you enjoyed being a heel more than a babyface?
Oh, but God,
all of
absolutely.
You?
We hated that. We became the fans liked us, but we didn't change our style of work at all.
Right.
We just didn't heal on them anymore.
Let's. We got time for maybe two more questions. Let's go ahead.
All right. Here's Andy.
I would totally in arm when y'all went to WWF. If the other horsemen would have followed, I'd think you would have fared in the late 80s WWF. Specifically, Rick, you going up against, especially Rick, you going up against Hogan at that point in time.
What? I'm sorry, we didn't hear that at all.
Totally in arm when you went to WWF.
Right.
If the other horsemen followed, how do you think you would have fared?
Okay, got you.
And Ric Flair, for you specifically, how would you done against Hogan at that point in time?
Yeah. How do you think the horsemen would have fared if they all went to the WWF when Tully and Arn left?
I think we did.
Oh, we don't. I'll tell you what happened. They left and we were all together the last night they went. And I know when they went and had a meeting and made a decision. And for them, it was the right thing. You know, I don't think wrestling, it's a huge, huge statement that I'm making, but I don't think the day that we ever separated, if you look at the history of drawing money as a team or as individuals or as a group, that breaking us up, I mean, the three of us were the core at that point. Barry was kind of doing those things. Lex had already gone. You know, I don't know that we ever would have found a fourth guy, but I don't know. I think that changed a lot of the history of the business. If you look at it from the angle of us as being in the business for a long time.
No question.
Here's another thing, too, is because I worked 7 years as executive vice president for Turner, and I also worked in that same position for Vince McMahon. And I learned very early on that Vince McMahon was... he's a genius. I mean, everything that he ever touched, he knew what to do with it. But also, Vince had this thing that he only pushed and got totally behind something that was his creation. That no matter how big the horsemen ever were, they were never going to reach that level because Vince wouldn't allow it to happen because it wasn't his creation.
Okay, let's do this. Let's go start with Lex. Just any final thoughts on being a horseman, the great days we had, just any final thoughts, wrapping it up here.
One thing that comes to my mind is people asking my highlights or greatest moment or moments. Mike Craig asked that question a lot. And this right here put me on the map for my entire career. And it was the greatest moment in time for me throughout my 15-year career is to have the foundation of being associated with this group up here right now. And I will always be very thankful to this group of guys up here.
Arn, final thoughts?
This very well could be just because of the lives we're all leading. Last time this panel will ever be together. And you can go back and second guess if you hadn't left or he hadn't left or what if this would have happened or what if that would have happened. I don't think we were appreciated at the time like we are today because we're kind of held up as a standard for factions by you guys. And I love you back. I love you back, guys.
Yep.
And if this faction of guys are never on a stage again, it won't be because there's heat or because so-and-so doesn't get along with so-and-so or whatever the deal is. It's just life goes on. But I can tell you this, and I always sing this guy's praises, thank God for Tony Khan, because he allowed you guys to dictate what we put on our television to an extent. And that wasn't, I know I spent 19 years with WWE, and I got to the point at the end, guys, where I hated the business, and I didn't think anybody would ever hear that come out of my mouth. He let he turned it over to the talent to do their thing, just like we did. We were never, ever given a finish, promo material, or anything else, because we were trusted to know what to do. And I just want to say that everybody here, I used to just, because I was the youngest probably of all of them, I used to marvel at all of your talents. Barry, you were as good as anybody's ever been in this business, period. Tully is the biggest asshole that's ever been born.
But he was our asshole.
JJ still has aged better than all of us. That's real heat. Lex, at the time, you were green, but goddamn, nobody looked like you, pal.
You did mean it when you called me an eggplant in the ring one time?
Yes. Quick story, you'll appreciate this. We're somewhere in California. It might have been L.A. at the Forum, and we're in a cage match with the Road Warriors and Tully. I mean, and who else was their partner? There was three. Was it Dusty? It was like a six-man.
Yeah, Dusty and the Road Warriors.
But some brain surgeon sent a cage that didn't fit. It fit right, instead of fitting against the apron, it fit against the ropes. So just asking, where were we supposed to stand? We stood inside the ring. Now, we're trapped in our corner all in the ring because you can't step out on the apron. Hawk being Hawk, and we all know who Road Warrior Hawk was, he had the bright idea that when Lex was in the ring, he would just tag in and just walk Lex right back into our corner with two of us else standing there. And Lex goes, Jesus Christ, Arn, Jesus Christ, what do I do? What do I do? I said, shut up, eggplant, I'm thinking. Thus, the eggplant.
There's the eggplant. Tully, any final thoughts?
You did
Tully?
Mean it.
He meant it.
Yeah.
It is 2022, and the stories and the thoughts were from 30 years ago and 35 years ago, and it's a tribute to everybody that sits up here that we impacted your lives, your families, your memories of this business, because that was our effort and our job, to be the best that we could be so that you guys could have the best time, so that you could get your money's worth every time you watched and you paid to watch us wrestle. And it is a mutual admiration right now, because this is the greatest group of guys, in my opinion, that was ever put together by chance. And you guys got to be the recipients of all that wrestling history. And it was a great honor to be part of it, and it's a great honor to sit up here with you guys on this stage.
All right. JJ?
How many other opportunities have there been for somebody creatively to say that they were going to try and create what we had? And if I heard it one time, I heard it a thousand times, that the fans will say, oh, they're trying to be like the Horsemen. And what they were saying was that the Horsemen was something that was spontaneous. We didn't plan it. It happened. And we just savored that time, and just each of us used our natural ability. And I know in my case, it really was only years later, reflecting back, that I realized what a magical time it was. And just to have been blessed to be in the business in that era, surrounded by that level of talent, And it wasn't, you know, an ego saying, oh, because we were that great. It just, because it wasn't any one individual, it was, it'll never, take my word, it'll never happen again. Because it was spontaneous. And you can take the credit for that. You made us what we were, and we just had enough sense to keep doing what we were doing because it was working. And when it was all said and done and we looked back, it wasn't until sometimes years later that we looked back and realized what a magical time in the business it was. And like for me, I'm so thankful that God allowed me to be a part of it.
Right. Barry?
Well, we've got a caption for what we are and what we went through, and we call it catching lightning in a bottle. That's what we were. That's what it was. It was lightning in a bottle.
It sure was. Many bottles with you, brother. Whew. Rick, go ahead, buddy.
So I was at Crockett Park. What year is that, Tony?
It was 1983.
In 1983, and there was this kid calling balls and strikes for a single old baseball team called the Charlotte O's.
Yeah.
Cal Ripken Jr. was playing there then. And we had a guy named Tom Miller that was doing interviews that just didn't really fit in the marketplace at that time. So I go to Jimmy Crockett and I said, there's a kid out there up in that wood box that needs to come to work in the wrestling business.
Yeah.
And here we are today, side by side.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know, man. It's when I was at my best in the ring, and it's the best time I ever had in the business. So countless memories made my heart. I think that we got inducted as a group. It was one of the biggest moments in the business, and greatest times, and I'm happy to see everybody. I hope this isn't our last reunion. I think they're in San Antonio next year. And I hope that we have an opportunity to talk about what's happened over the next 12 months.
37 years in December, the Horsemen were founded on a promo at the desk at TBS Studios. And now you see later what you guys mean to these guys and what these guys have meant to you. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you so much for your love of the Horsemen in pro wrestling. Ric Flair, Barry Windham, JJ, Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, Lex Luger, the Horsemen. Thank you.